Welcome to Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with Professor Hugh DeBruhl. He's a professor of history at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. We talk about his new book, Ambivalent Nation, How Britain Imagined the American Civil War. We don't talk so much about what specific groups thought, but rather the all the various ways in which the British people thought about the American Civil War. We talk about what they thought about certain operations, the war in general, leaders on both sides, the ways that the British got their information. We talk about how those attitudes sort of shaped what Americans thought and to some extent how they behaved in respect to the Civil War. So definitely an interesting sociological and cultural look at Britain during this time. And if you're interested in the American Civil War, you'll definitely really enjoy this interview. Well, thanks and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Hugh DeBruhl, author of Ambivalent Nation, How Britain Imagined the American Civil War. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you for calling me.
So first, how did you get into professional writing and into history?
It's one of those questions where, it doesn't admit of an easy answer. I think I would have to attribute at least part of it to my parents. Both of them grew up in France during World War II, mm-hmm. and so when I was little, they used to tell me stories about their experiences, and I thought that stuff was really fascinating. There was a real sort of you were there kind of spirit to the stories that they told. And I really got a real sense of how big, important historic events really affect people at the ground level. So I found that really, really fascinating. And I think the other thing the other way that they influenced me was when we were younger, when I was younger, they used to go on road trips and we used to visit historic sites and so on. And when we lived in Texas, when I was really little, they used to go on road trips in the Deep South. And it was on one of those trips that I actually had my very first memory, and that was visiting Vicksburg. And I was 3 years old, and I have a very vague recollection of being there. It was raining, it was cloudy. And I was on top of this high bluff, and my parents still have a picture of me. I think it was when I was 3 years old, and I was holding my teddy bear, and I was on the trail of a 3-inch ordnance artillery piece, mm-hmm. Holding my teddy bear. And I really got interested in the Civil War when I was really little. I think I even wrote a book about it that was like 10 pages long when I was 6. And so that's how I got into it. I went to college, and it was at that time I sort of started losing interest in American history, and I became much more interested in European history, in large part because I thought in some ways it was more dramatic. And eventually I went to graduate school, and I was, I did become actually a British historian, mm-hmm. and I was interested in writing on the British Empire and maybe something on World War I, and it was while I was playing around with that kind of question that I was thinking, well, I wonder how the Civil War sort of influenced British, the way the British thought about war and their conduct of operations, and if it had any kind of influence on World War I. And that's eventually how I kind of got into this topic.
Mm-hmm. So have you always wanted to write it sounds like you've always wanted to write a book on the Civil War and this topic. It's a thread since you were a little kid.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things you can't escape your fate sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Some authors I ask and the idea sort of came late in life, but it sounds like it was pretty much the seed was there from the very beginning.
Yeah, and I think it was a way that I could actually combine some of my interests. I mean, I was really interested in British history. I was interested in the Civil War, and this just, this thing seemed to come together.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the book itself.
So I wrote a dissertation on this topic, actually a long time ago. Not exactly the same topic and framed slightly differently. But what I was really interested in was that that question about how had the war potentially influenced the British before World War One, and I ran into Jay Lewis's book, The Military Legacy of the Civil War, and I thought, oh, I guess he's kind of cracked that problem. But it kind of turned out, as I was reading more and more primary sources and looking at the observations of British journalists and British soldiers and politicians and things of that nature, that I kind of felt that Lewis's book hadn't fully contextualized British thinking about the Civil War, and that his take on the military lessons that the British had learned didn't kind of fully take into account the fact that British attitudes toward military affairs were kind of a piece with sort of larger ideas that they had about American society and American politics, American nationality, American race, and things of that nature. So I kind of thought, well, you know what? I want to write about that. I want to write about how these topics, which were especially interesting to the British because they were wrestling with a number of issues, in their own right, both in the empire and at home, and how the Civil War sort of speaks to those kinds of questions and those kinds of problems. So that's kind of that's what the dissertation was about. To make a long story short, I wrote the dissertation, and a few years after it was done, I was really dissatisfied with it, and I wanted to kind of find a better way of conceiving of the questions that I had asked in the dissertation, and that's what this book is really about, because when I first wrote the dissertation, I had taken this fairly traditional approach to looking at these issues, and in the historiography of this question, for the longest time, scholars have, had cleanly divided British opinion into pro-Northern, pro-Southern, and, the pro-Northerners, so they're all middle class, they were radical, they were dissenters, they were, people of that nature, and the pro-Southerners, they were aristocratic, they were conservative, they belonged to the Church of England, and so on. And I had kind of written that dissertation in that style, and when I wrote the book, I wanted to find a way to, I wanted to find a theory that would allow me to make British opinion much more complicated and much messier, which is what I had really concluded was the case. And so, in this book, basically one of the main ideas that gets put forward is that, British attitudes toward America during the war are incredibly ambivalent. And much of that ambivalence really stems from the fact that they're still locked in this kind of post-colonial relationship, right? America's independent, but it's still so heavily reliant on Britain economically. It's still terribly reliant on Britain culturally. And that leads both sides to bear really conflicted and passionately conflicted feelings towards each other. And that really influences British attitudes toward the war.
So, whatever the attitudes, though, Britain was surely willing to financially profit from the war, hosting Confederate shipbuilding and, buying the cotton when it came in and all that.
Right.
So, how many different, okay, so you say it's messy, it's a messier view than people have put out in the past.
Correct.
How many, are there distinct strains of thought that maybe you could parse out, between two and a whole bunch?
Yeah, right, sure. In response to your first comment, I would say, the British certain sectors of the British economy did profit from the war, but as a whole, the war was incredibly disruptive for British trade. The blockade, of course, was terribly disruptive. And the fact that Northern vessels or American vessels were searching British vessels on the high seas constantly was just a real sort of thorn in their side. Mm-hmm. The war really disrupts the Anglo-American relationship. It really disrupts the trade, the sort of comfortable arrangements that had been made before the war. So, I think most Britons, if they've been given the choice between having a civil war and profiting what little they could from the war, or not having a war. I think the vast majority of them would have preferred not to have a war in the first place. So, trade, I mean, trade declined precipitously, and in part that's also because of the Morrill Tariff, which was passed in 1861, when the federal government jacked up protective tariffs, which also adversely affected British trade. But as for the other question about the sort of messiness of the thing, I think the thing to keep in mind is that I find very few characters involved in this story who are wholeheartedly in support of one side or another. And there are very few of them. I think one good example might be John Bright, who was a British radical leader who from the very beginning supported the North and just felt like, you know, the North was great, was terrific, and they could do no wrong. But lots of other people, a lot of radical leaders, were incredibly ambivalent. And what's really interesting is that one of the things you really notice, or what I noticed in doing the research for this book, is that a number of leaders will say something fairly uncomplicated in public about how they support this side or the other, or they support this policy or the other, but in private they are full of misgivings. They are second guessing themselves. They might support the North in public, but in private they're incredibly critical of the North for a variety of reasons. It could be one thing or another. And the same with the South. I mean, a lot of the propagandists for the South who are living in Britain at the time, a number of them, too, are, you know, they have mixed feelings about the side that they ostensibly support. And even in public, people are rather mixed in their opinions.
Considering the number of foreigners that were in the armies of the Civil War, especially a lot of Irish in the North, did that affect Great Britain attitudes as far as the Irish question?
It does in a couple of ways, actually. There was actually some concern in the British government that the United States surreptitiously was recruiting Irish people and bringing them over in one way or another. And so that did lead to actually some diplomatic friction. But what's also interesting is that the huge role of Irish immigrants in the war kind of feeds into one of these fairly common British narratives about the war, which I find it really interesting. One of the things that this book develops is that there are a series of stereotypes that the British buy into before the war. In the antebellum period, in the 30 to 40 years before the war, the British develop these images of America. And one of the images that they develop is that the North is primarily this middle-class democratic society that is characterized by both the strengths and weaknesses of a middle-class democracy. And that is to say, the good part of it is that they're really energetic, they're go-getters, they have this can-do attitude, and so on and so forth. The downside is they think that that kind of a society is, has low cultural attainments, is somewhat morally tainted by commerce, and so on and so forth. And so one of the sort of stereotypes that develops and emerges during the American Civil War is that, Northerners, they're commercially minded, they're middle class, they don't want to do the fighting themselves. What they're going to do is they're going to pay foreigners to do that, right? And that's the function of the Irish during the Civil War, at least according to the stereotype, is that, middle class Yankees, they don't want to go out and shoulder a rifle and go fight the South. They're going to pay to have Irishmen and Germans go do that kind of thing. So it does kind of feed into this, into British views of what Americans are like.
Mm-hmm. I recall an article I read some years ago, or a book actually, that suggested that a lot of northern coastal towns, the New Englanders were actually, a lot of them were opposed to the war because of the disruption to trade. So it's interesting listening to what you just said and just, thinking of New England as being so English, in people's minds. And yet here, what you've said is that the British looked at them not as connected to England, but rather kind of, dirtied by money.
Well, yeah, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. So in some ways, the British view America through British spectacles. And in many ways, when they look at the Yankee and they think of this sort of democratic middle class, they kind of think of their own middle class. And so in some ways, yes, they are chastising the Americans for having a lack of patriotic resolve, but in some ways it's another way of also sort of saying, look, you know, that we have our own sort of middle class at home. It resembles the American middle class, or rather the American middle class resembles our middle class. And a lot of the concerns that they have about the American middle class in the North are really reflections of their own concerns about their own middle class. So, in some ways, you could say, well, it's very closely related, right? And this is the sort of the problem of the post-colonial relationship. But getting to the other point, which I think is an interesting one, British commentators, or a number of British commentators, not all of them, when they are trying to understand the degree to which the Northern people have confidence, in the conflict, or confidence in their government, or so on and so forth, they're constantly looking at the stock exchange in New York, and they're constantly looking at the price of the dollar, which I find really, really interesting. Because I think, as we all know, you know, Wall Street and the strength of the currency are not necessarily great reflections of what public opinion really feels like.
Mm-hmm.
New York, you know, a lot of British people thought New York was kind of the real cultural and economic capital of the United States at the time, and I don't think they quite realized that New York in many ways was unique and somewhat different from the rest of the country, and that it was also, you know, the Democrats had a very, very heavy presence in New York City to a greater degree than they would have had maybe in other parts of the country. So it is kind of interesting that they were using the strength of the dollar as the kind of default measurement of the will of the North to win, when in fact really what it was is the opinion of businessmen and investors and finance, which is an altogether different thing.
In the book, how much of it, what's the ratio between how you discuss antebellum attitudes versus how attitudes during the war itself?
So the first chapter, it's only in the first chapter, and the first chapter is not short, and it's not cursory, but I found one of the things that worried me about other books on this topic was that they gave fairly short shrift to the antebellum period. And I think one of the sort of big themes that I try to press forward in this book is that the way in which the British approached the war and thought of the war was fundamentally influenced by the images and the ideas that they had developed in the antebellum era. So there's one chapter on that. The second chapter is about about British opinion and the difficulty of measuring that opinion and the complexity of that opinion. And then the other chapters are basically each about a different topic. So one of them is about how the British used the Civil War to talk about race. Another one is about how the British used the Civil War to talk about nationality. Another one is about how the British used the Civil War to talk about politics. And finally, there's one about military affairs as well. So in a sense, you know, I'm sort of focusing on issues that the British thought were really, really important and that really intersected with conversations that they were having at home that were particularly relevant to either themselves or their empire.
Did Canadian opinions feed into, you know, British opinions? Did what they think matter?
You know, that's really interesting, because the British were very, very concerned for Canadian security, and you know, actually, Canadian Confederation begins, like the process for Canadian Confederation begins during the Civil War and is completed in 1867. So actually, this federal Canadian state that we have today in some ways is a product of the Civil War. So the British were terribly concerned about Canadian security, and one of the fears that's frequently voiced is that if the North loses the Civil War, it will seek compensation to the North and seize Canada. And so Canadian security was foremost on the minds of British statesmen and the British public. And, you know, they feared that there would be this huge upset in the balance of North American power if the Americans invaded Canada. But what's really interesting is that a lot of these politicians and statesmen and journalists rarely, if ever, talked about what the Canadians thought about things. This was all viewed from the vantage point of London and London's interests and things of that nature, but hardly ever in the major metropolitan newspapers, hardly ever in any sort of venue did you really hear a whole lot about what Canadians thought about the war. And I, in part, that might be my fault because I'm actually looking at this from a British vantage point, but the British didn't really seem to think very much about what the Canadians were contemplating.
Did British naval officers have their own sort of unique stand on the issue, or did they blend in with some other groups?
Well, I have tended to focus a lot more on Army officers, in large part because so many more of them came to the United States. There were several military missions that came to the North to observe not just the Northern armies, but also to observe Northern factories and the methods by which Americans produce their artillery and things like that. There weren't a whole lot of naval officers coming to the United States, although towards the end of the war, the British actually posted one of their first naval attachés to Washington, D.C., which seems kind of surprising, you know, when you think about the steps that are being made with ironclad forces and things of that nature. Many, many more Army officers are either coming on their own and smuggling themselves in the South or just kind of wandering around the United States, or they're part of military missions.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that there was a lot of technical innovation during the Civil War. You know, both on the ground with some of the ground weapon, you know, the rifles and such, and also naval innovations. So that's just kind of an interesting aside there.
It is, and it's interesting because you know the British seem to be more interested in the technological developments and rather more dismissive of American tactics and American operations and American strategy. But that, I think, was part and parcel of their sort of, their dismissive attitude toward Northerners in general and Northern democracy, or at least their problematic view of Northern democracy, although they had a somewhat different view of the stuff.
So what did, what did British opinion really matter? You know, did it matter to Americans in the Civil War? You know, of what importance was it?
That is a great and complicated question. And I suppose you could say, you could think of different types of opinion. If say, the British government had decided to get involved in the war in one way or another, and at different times the British government did contemplate getting involved in the war, either to, mediate between the two sides, during the Trent Affair in December of 1861, there were serious preparations to actually fight a war against the North. So if the British government had decided to get involved in this war one way or another, I mean, obviously, I think it would have been a pretty serious burden for the federal government to bear as it was also fighting the Confederacy. But that's definitely something that could have, changed the tenor of the war, certainly. I think the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that Americans, as part of this post-colonial relationship, Americans cared very, very deeply about what the British thought. And post-colonial relationships are always a kind of a two-way street. The British felt, we're the mother country. You rely on us for trade, for finance, for labor, for all these types of things. Our authors are the people that you read. We have tremendous sort of moral and cultural sway in this country. And that gives us the right to hector you or guide you or instruct you or do something along those lines. And you would think, well, Americans would have blown that off or been very, very resentful. And at least, Americans were pretty resentful of it. But a number of them kind of recognized the force of this British argument. And, Americans had this very ambivalent relationship with Britain. On the one hand, they say, well, Britain's a very powerful country. They are the mother country. They are our kin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're very successful, they're very wealthy, they're very powerful, and in some ways we have to respect them, but by God, I really resent this patronizing attitude. And so Americans cared very deeply, they were very conflicted about their relationship with Britain, and when, British newspapers were very critical of American policy or Northern policy, Northerners were furious about it. I mean, it really steamed them to think that, you know, the British thought of them in the ways that they did. And you know, since the war takes the Anglo-American relationship and kind of pushes it to the breaking point in the course of the war, both sides are very, very stressed.
So when the war ended, were the British, were they scared of what would come next? Did they think the U.S. was just, like, burned out now and just going to collapse?
No, well, that's a great question. And the answer is, yeah, the British were worried about what was going to happen next. You know, now the Americans had raised these enormous armies. You know, I mean, the Northern armies at the end of the war were huge compared with anything the British could send to Canada. And so there was a real concern that, the United States potentially could take over Canada. But I think there was also a concern about what would happen to America itself after the war. Even after the defeat of the Confederacy, there were some concerns that, you know, maybe the federal government might descend into some sort of military dictatorship, because certainly generals and soldiers were much more prominent than they had been in the recent past.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're kind of worried about the course that America would take. You know, would America remain a somewhat stable state? Would it pay off its debts? Would it be a good sort of transatlantic partner? You know, there were all these kinds of questions that really weren't resolved until the end of Reconstruction. So in 1865, I think, you know, the British are thanking God that the war is over. But by the same token, they're also concerned about what the future course of Reconstruction will look like and what course the United States will take in the future.
Did you see, what sort of attitudes did you see towards Lincoln and Jefferson Davis during the course of the war?
Oh, so, nowadays everybody's into Lincoln worship, but much of the British press, many British politicians, a lot of them were very, very critical of Lincoln. They thought that he was unfit for his position. They thought that they thought his rhetoric was really, really off and didn't make a whole lot of sense. So there was a great deal of criticism of Lincoln during the war in the British press. Now, there were elements of the press, especially the working class press in Britain, that were also critical of Lincoln, but they also saw the elevation of Lincoln as president as a sort of great mark in America's favor, right? You know, that a working class guy could become president of the United States, they thought spoke volumes about, you know, American equality and American social mobility and things of that nature. But there was a lot of criticism of Lincoln and federal policy throughout the war, especially among the elite press. Davis, surprisingly, actually fared fairly well in the British press, especially in the metropolitan press. And this kind of fed into this British attitude that the Civil War pitted this middle-class democracy against some sort of Southern aristocracy, that might be too strong of a term, but these gentlemen in the South and so on and so forth who had this great aptitude for military and political leadership, and that Davis was part of that class. Now, obviously, a lot of British observers and critics, you know, did not give the South a free pass for slavery because, you know, Britain was a very much an abolitionist nation, although their attitudes toward race were really, really complex. But they gave Davis high marks for political leadership, and obviously they gave people like Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee high marks for military leadership. And they saw these people as a product of an aristocratic society, or at least a society that had an aristocratic character.
Mm-hmm. What about during the war, Sherman's March to the Sea? Did they get reports of, like, the Sherman's policy to just destroy the South, you know, and Grant's, you know?
Yeah. No, and this was a big topic of discussion, and in the chapter on the conduct of operations and the way in which the British saw American military affairs, I talk about this a bit. And there was some real ambivalence about that. A lot of people, with only a couple of exceptions, but a lot of military observers gave Sherman very, very high marks for his campaign against Atlanta, and also for his March to the Sea. You know, here's a guy who completely outmaneuvered Johnson on the way to Atlanta, and then basically completely disregarded his own lines of communication and just, like, struck out into Georgia, out to the sea. And a lot of people were pretty impressed with that, but they were also kind of appalled by the material destruction that was associated with the march. And in some ways, that fed into their view that democratic warfare was going to be especially disruptive and destructive as well. So Sherman comes out actually probably, at least among most British observers, Sherman came out looking better than Grant did. They were very impressed with him, but they were very, very uncomfortable with this sort of this war of exhaustion that Sherman is waging on the Southern home front. Even though, you know, Grant is sort of participating in the, you know, in the very same kind of strategy of exhaustion against the Southerners in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
But they tended to rate Grant somewhat lower, and I think unfairly. And that's one of a number of things that the British get wrong about the war. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
So, tell me about the resources that you used for this research.
So, let's see. So, there were a number of contemporary books that came out that I read. Some of them were kind of propagandistic, you know, supporting one side or the other. But there were a number of books, travel literature, things of that nature, a lot of pamphlets, tons of newspapers, weeklies, monthlies, quarterlies. Took a look at a number of official documents, so that would be reports from military missions, reports from councils and legations, cabinet memoranda, and then I looked at a lot of private correspondence, so politicians, journalists, military officers, even got a chance to look at some newspaper archives to see what journalists were writing to their editors and their editors were writing back, so that's pretty much the kind of stuff I was looking at.
Where did you find all this material? What different locations?
All over Britain. so, you know, a lot of the books are available in the United States. That's not a problem, especially now, you know, just everything's available on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the pamphlets are available, too. But Britain has, the British Library has a wonderful newspaper library. And so you can get your hands on a number of newspapers, either on microfilm or in the original, which is just fantastic. A lot of the weeklies, the monthlies, the quarterlies, you can see them there as well. That's pretty cool. The official documents, all that stuff is going to be at the National Archives outside of London. And then the private correspondence and the diaries and that kind of stuff, that was available in archives all over England. So some of them, you know, were available at the British Library. Some of them were available at the National Archives, but then a bunch of them were available at different record offices in different counties of England. So it did involve a lot of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually wrote down here, I actually ended up going to 25 different archives in Britain.
Wow. What were the major newspapers in that period?
Up until about the mid-1850s, the London Times was like the newspaper, and it was the newspaper written by important people for important people. And, you know, by the mid-1850s, I think it had a circulation of about 70,000. So the circulation was important, but it was also the kind of people who wrote and read the Times that were important. So that was a very important paper. But one of the things that happens in the course of the mid-1850s is that the price of newspaper drops rather substantially because the last of the taxes on newspapers are removed, and that makes it possible to start printing newspapers for a penny, like daily newspapers for a penny a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of other newspapers start emerging during this period, which are cheaper than the Times and have somewhat larger circulation. And so you have things like the Daily Telegraph gets started, which is still around today. The Standard, which is somewhat more conservative, which is still around today. And then you have a number of these working-class weeklies that have started appearing in this period that have huge circulation. So if the Standard and the Daily Telegraph have, like, circulations of over 100,000, You know, Reynolds Weekly, you know, newspapers like that, which were working class weeklies, they have circulations of probably somewhere upwards of 200,000. So Britain doesn't really have national newspapers in a sense at the time, but the papers that are printed in London with the big circulations, they're the ones that have the most money. They can send correspondents overseas. You know, they can do that sort of in-depth analysis, and they become kind of de facto national papers.
I'm sorry if you might have mentioned it, but did they have, you know how the U.S. had plenty of the illustrated newspapers, you know?
Yeah.
Did Britain have those?
Yes, they did, as a matter of fact. And so the Illustrated London News was sort of the, they were the pioneer in that kind of journalism in Britain. And I think the Illustrated London News got started in 1848. I want to hazard that as a guess. Mm-hmm. But they have... they had extensive Civil War coverage, and in fact, they sent a correspondent, an artist, to the United States, Frank Vizetelli, who was here for the entire war. He covered the northern side from 1861 to 1862, and then he smuggled himself into the Confederacy. He experienced a change of heart. He supported the North at the beginning. Some events occurred, and he kind of changed his attitude. He smuggled himself in the South, and he covered the war from the South, although he had real difficulty smuggling his illustrations out of Confederacy due to the blockade.
Mm-hmm.
It so turns out, I'm trying to remember which university has this, but they actually have all of his illustrations online along with the articles that accompany them, and they're just absolutely fantastic. It's not Duke. Oh, where is it? Oh, it's at Emory University, actually. They have them, and it's absolutely fantastic. And that, and the Illustrated London News had a huge circulation as well, probably over 100,000.
Because I'd imagine illustrations, you know, a population that maybe wasn't, you know, fully literate, you know, Illustrated News would seem to be popular.
Yeah, although I would say, you know, looking at the Illustrated London News, that's probably like a middle-class audience. Because, you know, Illustrated London News, that was a weekly, I can't remember how much it cost, but, you know, most of the working class, you know, working class papers, they were like one penny a week, you know, which is about what people of that station could afford. But the Illustrated London News, I mean, it's pretty interesting, and it seems like it's tailored for a middle class audience. Although, boy, you could get quite an education looking at those pictures because, you know, not just for the Civil War, but they'll have pictures of Ottoman Turkey and Japan and all this other stuff there. And it's if you're trying to do research, it's very easy to waste time looking at the pictures.
So did you come across any artifacts or objects of interest in?
Oh, yes. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I don't want to go into get in any trouble. But I went to this record office and... I knew that the papers of this guy who had smuggled himself into the South, he was the son of a very, very well-known aristocrat. This guy smuggled himself into the South, and he went into Richmond, and he came back, and he eventually wrote some articles for some well-known monthlies. And I thought, oh, this would be a great chance. I want to go see his papers and so on. So I went to the record office, and I talked to the archivist, and she said, well, we don't really have a good list of what's in these boxes with his stuff in it, you know. So I don't really know what's in there, you know. It's just like box one, block to this guy, right? So she brings me the boxes. I open the boxes, and it's got a bunch of Confederate newspapers in them, and I think, well, that's promising. But it's also got this diary in there, and so I open the diary up. I had no idea this guy had kept the diary, and it only has four entries in it, and one of them... I think it's like the second entry. He's just arrived in New York before he smuggles himself into the South. And he talks about his visit to a New York brothel and says that this brothel is just like everything else in America. It's cheap and tacky and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like a Yelp review for a brothel. But in any event, I mean, that was probably the most salacious and surprising thing that I found. And then, of course, he only has three more entries, and that's it with the diary he's done with it. So
that's funny. So what part of the research was most enjoyable?
You know, I really liked traveling in Britain, I have to say. I mean, it was, you know, I was rushing around from place to place, but I got to see a lot of the country, and that was a lot of fun. I mean, it was kind of expensive, but it was fun. You know, I traveled all the way up to Scotland. I went all the way out, you know, west to Wales. I even got to go to Ireland, go to Dublin. I was in most parts of the country, and it was hectic, and it was time-consuming, and it could be draining, but it was a lot of fun, and I really did enjoy that part of it.
Cool. So apart from this guy's diary, was there anything else that you would consider the most surprising part of your research?
Well, I think, I would say, I think the most surprising part was the extent to which people's public and private opinions really were very different sometimes. And I mean, I suppose that shouldn't surprise us. You know, I bet, you know, of course, nowadays politicians say things in public and probably believe things in private, but it really is an interesting thing to see. You know, you read the personal correspondence to their friends and they're wringing their hands and so on and so forth, and they're saying almost something completely different in public. And I thought that was, I just found that kind of fascinating. I think the other thing that I found equally fascinating that's somewhat related is that the British, you know, a lot of people made this comment at the time, and that was that they may disagree on their sympathies or for whom they felt sympathies in the war, but they all agreed on the policy that Britain should follow, which was neutrality. I found that was really, really interesting that, you know, there are a lot of people out there, and they're, you know, they're pro-Confederate, they're pro-Northern, but it didn't really matter what they believed in. They all believed that, you know, Britain should remain neutral in the conflict. And this is something that a number of journalists remarked on over and over again, and I thought that was really, really interesting, that no matter what your sympathies were, they all agreed that Britain should stay out of the war.
So which British public figure of the time would readers find be most surprised as far as having differing public and private opinions? Is there someone that...
You mean somebody that people would actually know these days, or just in general?
Well, people who maybe know more of the subject than your average person.
Right. Well, you know, interestingly, there was this correspondent for the London Times, Frank Lawley, who spent, he spent 3 years in the Confederacy, and he was... he was a very aggressive pro-Confederate propagandist, but in a lot of his personal correspondence back home, he comes across as a very anguished figure. And, you know, on the one hand, he's, you know, in public, he's writing this correspondence, you know, he's upholding the South, he's twisting things in fairly blatant ways. And in private, you know, writing to some of his friends home in Britain, he really seems rather tortured about the whole thing and realizes the Confederacy is not what he wants it to be, and maybe not in the ways that we would think. He actually thought slavery was an elevating influence on the white population, and he's one of the few Britons who actually didn't think slavery was a terrible thing. What he was most concerned about, he thought that the South was going the way of the North and becoming grubby and, you know, money grubbing and commercial and so on and so forth. But he would never admit that in his public correspondence. So that that's just one example I can think of off the top of my head that really was striking to me.
That's interesting. Was there something in your research that was particularly difficult to come to a conclusion on, or maybe is still a mystery to you?
You know, I would... You know, when I originally wrote the dissertation, and I approached it in this sort of traditional way of sort of separating it into partisans of the North and partisans of the South, before I kind of embraced the ambivalence, I think, like, that period when I became dissatisfied with the dissertation and decided to move forward with trying to find out some sort of idea that kind of unlocked the whole thing, I think that was the most difficult part of it. Was sort of reconceptualizing the argument that I was making and sort of trying to find that theory that sort of unlocked British opinion, which was, you know, this idea that they are locked in this post-colonial relationship. And that's not the only thing that influences Anglo-American relations and British perceptions of America and so on and so forth, but it's this thing that kind of permeates a lot of ideas and influences British ideas to a large extent. And I think reaching for that theory, reaching for that argument, was the thing that was difficult to find. Although I would say this, I mean, you know, the book is about ambivalence, you know, and in some ways, when you talk about ambivalence, it's an unresolved thing, right? I mean, if people have conflicted feelings, they don't really reach resolution. And I would say, you know, this book is very much characterized by the fact that the British do feel somewhat unresolved with regard to America during the war, because they've got these conflicted ideas, and it's difficult for them to reach resolution.
So was there anything that might have emotionally moved you during your research? Anything particularly happy or sad that you came across?
There's a lot of things. There are a lot of passages that I like that I came across when I was doing research. There's one story that I really like. Edward Dicey was a British correspondent who visited the North during the war, and he was a correspondent for The Spectator. And he traveled all over the North. I mean, he was in New England, he was in New York, he went to the Midwest, he went, you know, all the way out to Iowa. And he wrote, you know, ostensibly he was there to report about the war, but he was really kind of interested with Americans, and he thought about Americans a great deal and who they were and what they were about. And at one point, he's taking this train in Massachusetts, and he's trying to kind of get to grips with American patriotism, which was something the British really had great difficulty understanding. And that's one of the mysteries of the book. I don't quite understand why the British found it so difficult to understand why the Americans could be patriotic at the time. But he's trying to come to grips with this question, and he's on this train, and he's sitting across this soldier who's really, really ill and sick and worn out and really skinny. And on the other side of the carriage is this woman, and apparently this woman has lost her husband and has lost her brother already in the fighting during the 7 days battle. And the two of them are having this conversation, and basically, you know, they talk about their problems and their woes and so on and so forth. And eventually, the soldier, who's all worn out, says to the woman, he says, you know, after all, it was for our country and we're bound to do it. And the woman says something like, yep, you're right. And Dicey says, you know, those words are kind of vulgar, but there's something of true heroism in that. And I thought that, you know, that was really, really cool. And I thought that was really a sort of uplifting thing for him to have seen in that moment.
The way you described it, I could just imagine it going on and the soldier just kind of saying, hey, look.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm still angry.
Yeah.
The fact he said, you know, it was for our country and we were bound to do it. And she says, yeah, you're right. And Dicey concludes from that. He says, you know, this is what true heroism is. And I think he was trying to say something about the sort of profound, you know, the moving nature of American nationalism and American patriotism at the time.
I mean, the British certainly, I'm sure, understood patriotism, but did they think it depended on having hundreds of years of history, you know, to base it on, or?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, nowadays, a lot of scholars spend time studying Southern nationalism and, you know, talking about Southern nationalism as a work of progress. Did it exist? Did it not exist? How strong was it? And so on and so forth. But what's really interesting, I think, is that the British thought that the nationalism that was problematic during the war was Northern nationalism. And they felt, interestingly enough, you know, that the United States was just too big, you know. geographically, it was too big. Ethnically, it just had too many different people there, and there was no great history holding these people together. And, you know, the only thing they argued that really held Americans, or at least the Northerners, together was this sort of vision of territorial grandeur, not some sort of, you know, not some profound idea, not some, you know, anchor from the past or anything like that, but just this territorial grandeur, just this bigness for the sake of bigness. And they said that's not an idea that's profound enough or deep enough to kind of hold the people together. And, you know, the real problem is, you know, the North breaking apart, not so much the South breaking apart. And this is, I mean, a lot of the other things I've said up until this point, you know, there was conflicting opinions about, but this was something that was almost universally believed among a large number of observers and commentators, that, the United States was not really a nation.
So they saw it just basically as its individual states sort of tied together with weak threads?
Yeah, I mean, that, and but also individuals tied together with weak threads. Here we are in this sort of go-getting, commercial-minded society where everybody's looking out for themselves, and there's just no real great idea behind all of it. Nothing that you could say, that's what America stands for. And this is one of the areas where I think the British really got it wrong very, very badly in the course of the war. Was not really seeing what it was, and really the strength of Northern resolve to bring this war to an end.
So with that in mind, I can really see why they might have been twisted into knots understanding how they could field such huge armies that fought, that stayed together long enough to win the war.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, but if you believe that those armies are full of, like, Irish and German mercenaries, then you can just sort of write that off and say, well, that's not a representation of, a profound national feeling. That's just a representation of a reckless spending of money or something along those lines.
Interesting. Well, that's...
But again, as with everything else, I mean, there are certainly people who are willing to take up the opposite side of the argument and say, you've got it all wrong. But American nationalism was something that was very, very difficult for the British to understand during the war.
So what do you hope the book will do?
Well, I think this book is not really about, British public opinion about who believed what. It's more about how the British thought about the war. And I think a lot of previous work have dwelled on British public opinion, who believed what. So I guess what I'm hoping will happen is that it will take this discussion of British attitudes toward America during the Civil War, to a different area than it's been in the past, because for so long we've talked about, well, this group of people believe this and this group of people believe that, and this book really talks about, well, the sort of general way in which the British thought about the war. So maybe we won't be talking anymore about, which groups believe what anymore and start thinking about sort of maybe a bigger picture.
Okay. Did you have any difficulties getting the book published? And if so, how did you overcome those?
Well, I was really, really lucky. I obviously was going to start looking for presses and so on and so forth. And actually, it almost dropped into my lap. I mean, Louisiana State University Press contacted me and said, hey, we heard you're working on a book. Could you tell us about it? And I told them about it and said, well, can you write a proposal? So I wrote a proposal. And they liked it. And at that point, the book was already about two-thirds done. And, I signed a preliminary contract with them. And when I delivered the final manuscript, they asked me for a number of revisions. But it was not a struggle, let me put it that way.
Okay, good. What's your next writing project?
So, yeah, complete change of direction. it took me a while to sort of figure out what I was going to do. But right now, what I am interested in looking at, and this grew out of a project that I was supervising for undergraduates at the college where I teach, but I am thinking of writing a book about the 5th New Hampshire Volunteer Infantry, which holds the dubious distinction of having lost more combat fatalities than any other Union regiment during the Civil War. So, and I think part of it has to do with the fact that I found it really, really difficult to oversee an undergraduate research project and then also maintain my own research on something completely different. But the other benefit is that a lot of the sources are right here in New Hampshire.
So where can people find your work?
Well, you can find it on Amazon, and you can find it at Louisiana State University Press's website. That's all I'm conscious of or aware of at this moment.
Okay. So no webpage or social media or anything like that?
Beg your pardon?
Webpage or social media accounts or anything?
I'm in the middle of, trying to deal with that right now, so hopefully I can get something up to that.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Any final thoughts or words?
No, I think we've talked for a long time. I don't want to exhaust the patience of your listeners.
No, that's fine. We're within the 55 minutes I try to stick to, so.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
No, well, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez Warscholar, on YouTube under warscholar1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.